We move to the second case this morning, Al-Jabari v. Holder. Mr. Roth.
Good morning, Your Honor, Counsel. May it please the Court. I'm Charles Roth for the petitioner, Mr. Al-Jabari. I'm going to focus my argument today on the two issues that the Court asked us to address specifically, but I want to briefly discuss the District Court's jurisdictional ruling before I get there. The government doesn't attempt to defend the District Court's jurisdictional ruling. The District Court sua sponte dismissed this matter, citing 8 U.S.C. 1252 A2B2. That's plainly wrong. The Supreme Court in the Kuchana decision...
Quick way of getting rid of it, though, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And the District Court cited a number of the District Court's own opinions citing that provision of law, including in this very context. We think those decisions all have problems, but in this particular context, it's just plainly wrong, which is why the government doesn't try to defend it.
Roth, here's what I want to know. Suppose, you know, everybody seems to agree on the jurisdictional point, and that seems sound to me. Suppose we were to agree with our sister circuits about the exclusivity of jurisdiction on a particular issue at any given time, which I think would mean a finding that the May 3rd, 2012 action of USCIS would have to be set aside. And then the government proposes that if we get that far, we really just need to remand to the district court and let it deal with this case. That makes a lot of sense to me, to be honest, and because it seems to me there are all sorts of issues floating around that would be better presented at the first instance to the district court. USCIS has points that it would like to make. Why isn't that the right outcome?
Your Honor, I think both parties are in agreement that the merits of the matter ought to be sent back to the district court. I think both parties feel the need to defend the merits of the position in a way just to, you know, hey.
You would agree with Judge Wood that sending it back and letting the district court sort it out or send it back to the immigration?
To the district court, yes, Your Honor. The government argues, before we get there, they argue that the case is moot because of the intervening USCIS decision purporting to deny the naturalization case. And if the government were correct and all the other circuits to address the issue were wrong, then it would be moot. And then I suppose that would implicate Article 3, and the court maybe should dismiss the matter before you get there. And so we agree with the government that you should reach that point, and we think that you should rule in favor of Mr. Al-Jabari on that point. And having reached that point, then it would make sense to remand the matter to the district court.
Maybe the key question before us then is whether once the district court has jurisdiction over this matter, CIS needs to wait. And just like, you know, even if I'm thinking of analogies, you know, if we get an appeal on a class action Fairness Act case, then the class action issues are before us. Even if the district court can continue supervising discovery or doing some other things, it doesn't have authority over the class action points until we're done. So I take it, you know, it's the Second, Fourth, and Ninth Circuits have all said, yes, this statute should work the same way, and the word remand suggests that that's how it works and other things.
Yes, Your Honor. And the option for the district court to determine the matter seems inconsistent with the USCIS being able to oust jurisdiction and have itself determine the matter. I'll move to those.
So the government says, why not an all of the above option? Why isn't the district court somehow just a supplement to USCIS?
Well, of course, this only comes up when USCIS wants to deny the naturalization. I mean, if USCIS wanted to grant the naturalization application, realistically, the parties aren't going to.
Nobody would object.
Right. So then either have an offer of judgment, you could remand it. There's a million ways to settle a case, right? The issue comes up when they want to deny the application, which would then trigger extra routes of appellate review and then a return to the federal court under 1421. And so we actually thought some of the court's case law in doctors and nurses rehab center was actually relatively on point. The government cited it, and we agree that it actually is a relevant decision. There, this court said, look, if the agency can sort of oust federal court jurisdiction at any point, and at this point they would have claimed to oust it while the matter was on appeal to this court, you know, maybe it's efficient in one case, but it may be inefficient in other cases, and it's the district court has sound discretion to decide whether to determine the matter, whether to remand the matter to the agency to have the agency determine the matter.
Would such a remand go to CIS or to the Board of Immigration Appeals?
Naturalization is given to the Department of Homeland Security, USCIS. Yes, Your Honor.
Could we send it back with directions to do that? Send it back to the
district court with directions to remand to the agency. I suppose the court could do that. It isn't really a matter that's been briefed or argued, and I would hope you would not. I think there are discretionary factors that
That's not something you necessarily agree or disagree with the government. It just adds an issue.
Yes, Your Honor. The district court could decide to remand it. It could decide to stay the matter, to just wait for further administrative proceedings if it felt that was more appropriate. The textual basis for the government's argument is weak at best. They try to sort of solve their textual problem by resorting to legislative history. They say that the Congress did strip the word exclusive from in front of the word jurisdiction, and that's true. At the same time they did that, the proposed bill would have allowed a naturalization applicant to, in a case of delay, to go into district court, and then the district court would have had exclusive jurisdiction to decide the matter. What Congress did was it said, well, actually, we're going to strip the word exclusive, and we're going to allow the district court either to decide the matter or to remand the matter with or without instructions. And so we think the elimination of the word exclusive was tied to the authorization of the district court to either decide the matter or to remand the matter. And there's analogies, I believe, the court in doctors' rehab centers, the section 405G of 42 USC is a similar sort of statute, allows the government to seek remand in a Medicare case, and there are various discretionary factors that would guide a district court's decision whether to grant that kind of relief or non-relief, I guess. The court also, I'm not sure.
So let me ask you another question, because I love procedure and I want to do things the right way and all of that. But at the end of the day, it's hard for me to imagine an exercise of discretion in favor of Mr. Al-Jabri's naturalization application, given his record. And one of the points the government makes is that up until the moment the oath of allegiance is administered, the government can take good moral character into account. And here's a man who stands convicted of both wire fraud and structuring, or money laundering, sorry. No, the money laundering gets vacated. So wire fraud and structuring. And, you know, you at some point, I think, contest whether they actually can still take into account this rather sorry record of behavior that he's come up with. And I'd like to hear you explain why not.
Well, you know, it may be that, I mean, I'm not sure how, whether we would win in the end of the day, but it does seem that the government's argument might sound more plausible in this case than in other cases. The government delay has taken a good moral character period of about 3 years and extended it into about 14 years.
But
and
why,
at some point
why
you have
does
to
that disable the government from looking? It's like, you know, you have to behave yourself for 3 years, but then the sky's the limit? I mean, I don't see that.
No, but the good moral character bar, Congress has never defined good moral character. Judge Hand 50 years ago or so defined it as, you know, being in keeping with sort of community standards of decency. What Congress has done, although they haven't defined it, is they've added some bars to showing good moral character. So a person who, for instance, commits a shoplifting offense would be barred from showing good moral character. A person who admits committing the shoplifting offense, even if Walmart doesn't decide to prosecute, would be barred from showing good moral character. And so,
what about wire fraud? I mean, you know.
But I'm just pointing out that the consequence of extending this period from 3 years to 14 years may not be as evident here on these facts as it would be on some other facts. And so we just would, you know, we haven't fully briefed those issues. The court ordered us to address two issues,
sure,
which are jurisdictional
okay.
in nature, and address them. And we think that further.
It doesn't make any difference whether it was 3 or 14, though, right? I mean, as far as ultimate disposition wouldn't hinge on the time expended.
Well, yeah, that would, I mean, the amount of time of the years end up depending on how long the government, under the government's view of things, the period of good moral character depends on how long they take to adjudicate it. And if they, you know, lose it for a decade or more, then the period sort of gets extended indefinitely.
And are you contesting that or not?
Well, it's one of the questions that we think.
See, the district court should worry about that on remand.
Right. I allude to it in a paragraph, which I'm not sure is even sufficient to really exhaust it. I just wanted to raise some of the issues that could be argued in district court, and whether they would make a difference and ought to be argued in this case below, I'm not sure. The court also asked us to address the jurisdictional effects of 1429. Both the parties are in agreement that 1429 isn't jurisdictional in nature. We think the recent decision in Clene probably disposes of that. I mean, it's a mandatory rule that governs the availability of relief, but it's not a jurisdictional rule that limits the federal court's authority to consider the matter. The parties aren't in agreement about whether 1429 prevents an effective remedy along the lines of declaratory judgment. Now, and whether that's a question you would choose to address currently is, you know, that's the court's sound judgment, whether you feel it's appropriate to discuss it now or whether it makes more sense to remand to the district court and decide whether it matters in this case. But
it would be unusual for us, in the first instance, I think, to look at that.
The court ordered us to address the jurisdictional impact of it. Now, the courts, as the Clene decision recounts, there's a bit of a split. Some courts say that there's jurisdiction, but there's no possible remedy, so the case is dismissed. Some courts say there's no, well, at least as the court read it in Clene, some courts may say that there's no jurisdiction. This court in the Third Circuit have found that there can be an effective remedy even where naturalization itself is barred by 1429. So it's a similar issue to the jurisdictional matter, but it is conceptually distinct. We just want to make sure that
you're in your rebuttal time.
Oh, my goodness. I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Unless the government agrees with everything you said, then they won't have to worry about it. Do you? No.
No. May it please the Court. I am Aram Gavor from the Department of Justice, and I represent the federal government defendants' appellees. Building upon Judge Wood's concept of procedure, I think there are two fundamental threshold arguments that really can allow the Court to dispose of this entire action at this juncture. First, and this is building upon the 28J letter that the government filed on September 18th, the court can dismiss this action as moot because United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, at the time at which it adjudicated the N-400 application, there was a final order of removal, so there's no bar under 1429 to adjudicate, and also the district court had dismissed the case and denied the 59E motion. So at that time, the ability to adjudicate the N-400 was there. And the question of concurrent or exclusive jurisdiction under 1447B is not squarely before the court.
For appeal hadn't expired. I mean, there's an appeal.
Yes, Your
Honor.
You
know, and to kind of this, your concept that you just jump in and nip off the appeal is an odd concept of judicial process. Usually, for example, we wait until the time for filing a petition for cert has expired and no petition is filed, or we wait for the time filing a notice of appeal to expire before we are confident that the case is really over with. And so it's an unattractive theory and one which I think would lead to a lot of gamesmanship on the part of the government.
Well, Your Honor, the government acknowledges that point. And certainly it may be an ambitious theory, but I would certainly say it's one that's taken in good faith for a variety of reasons. First, under Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 8A2, Mr. Al-Jabri did not file a motion seeking a stay of the lawful effect of that district court order, dismissing the case sua sponte or the 59E denial, although he did file a motion for stay of removal, which this court granted.
Right, and I would also say that motion alone signals that this court is saying we are paying attention to this case, removal needs to wait until we finish. That's what those orders always say. Had we not issued that, this might look a little bit different, but you're essentially saying the minute the words fall from the lips of the district court judge denying the 59E motion, counsel needs to stand up and say, we move for a stay of everything, you know, not just a stay of removal, a stay of everything. I don't think there's a legal difference there. It's not your strongest argument.
Understood, Your Honor. So let me move on. The second argument, which can allow this court to address at the threshold this issue on appeal, is one of simple harmless error. The court can affirm the district court's decision on harmless error, even though 1252A2B2 was an inappropriate basis of sua sponte dismissal or dismissal at all, for three reasons. First, Mr. Al-Jabri will never naturalize because he is permanently barred from doing so because of his aggravated felony structuring and wire fraud convictions.
But that's jumping ahead to the merits. The district court makes this jurisdictional mistake that everybody agrees. You know, he's not looking at the right subchapter of the statute. And I have to believe that one of the interests of, if not petitioner, of his counsel is that keeping the trains running the right way, you know, when is there jurisdiction in the district court? This is an unusual part of the immigration laws. Usually this is a very agency, you know, Attorney General, Department of Homeland Security run system. But this part gives the district courts a role, and sorting out when the district courts have authority over the action and when the agency does is of significant general interest. There's even an embanked decision in the Ninth Circuit about this issue, and even the Ninth Circuit doesn't take cases in bank all that often. So you may well be, you know, assured of victory when this case goes back to the district court, but it doesn't mean that we get to ignore erroneous jurisdictional rulings. You say, well, actually, you do have jurisdiction, now we're going to jump in and do everything.
Certainly, Your Honor, the government does not contend even for a moment and fully acknowledges it's not really a concession because the government was never before the district court.
Right, you're never served.
The government
right?
has not been served yet. And in fact, the first time the government...
So you hear amicus? What's your capacity?
No, the government was served... Well, I came in on the case sort of midsummer, but the government was first notified of this case when it was served with a notice of appeal. So at the threshold question, there was not even service under 4I upon the U.S. Attorney's Office or the Attorney General in D.C. Secondarily, looking at the language of the complaint, this is not even necessarily a 1447B case, Your Honor. The complaint specifically asks for mandamus and APA relief, which is an available form of relief.
It's pro se, right?
Correct. And generally, the court, you know, the Supreme Court admonished in Haynes that the pleading standards are less stringent for a pro se plaintiff.
And people don't need to plead legal theories.
Correct. But there's still a basement, a certain level at which there needs to be a pleading. And certainly in this circumstance, Mr. Al-Jabri probably should not be given such a broad or less stringent pleading requirement, given that he's a frequent filer, he successfully appealed his criminal convictions, at least in part, for the money laundering and part of his sentencing. He had the sophistication to file a 59E motion. He had the sophistication to file a motion to stay, and in addition to that, a motion for clarification on appointment of counsel. So in this circumstance, Mr. Al-Jabri, while pro se at the time he filed his complaint, which Mr. Roth infers is a 1447B case, really was seeking just mandamus relief.
But, you know, Mr. Gabor, I have to say, habeas is probably more complicated than the immigration laws. But the immigration laws are among the most complex of statutory mechanisms that I've ever seen. Makes me long for the days of the forms of action at common law. And to guess whether you're a mandamus person or an APA person or an appeal to the district court or asking CIS or BIA, or it's a nightmare. So even if Mr. Al-Jabri has managed to navigate this, I think it's pretty clear what he's asking for in that petition is the relief that is now being argued for in a much more straightforward way by Mr. Roth.
Certainly, Judge Wood.
I mean, labels to one side.
You know, and the question as to whether to apply a less stringent pleading standard is that the province of the court? So the court gets to decide that.
I'm not even sure a lawyer couldn't come in and cite the wrong statute or cause of action under a notice pleading regime. If you can see what they're looking for, that even in the twickball world might be fine.
Well, Your Honor, the government would note, just before it moves on, is that mandamus actually is an available form of relief for, as Mr. Roth would style it, a languishing N-400 application for naturalization. So Mr. Al-Jabri didn't indeed plead an improper basis where there was no jurisdiction. He actually pled a bona fide, legitimate way to get himself in a federal court cause of action. Now, the second question as to whether he failed to state a claim because of his convictions and his criminal history is a totally different question. But here, he didn't entirely fail. He did properly cite a waiver of sovereign immunity and the grounds of jurisdiction. But moving on, for the court's consideration, this if the court wants to take a third choice to remand, the government's briefing stands. It lays out a rather straightforward way to do so. And because of the procedural complexities, as the court recognizes, and the questions of immigration law, this court can remand as well back the district court. And the nature of the remand can be something along the lines of 8 U.S. Code Section 1252 A2B2 is an inappropriate basis to dismiss a case filed under mandamus for naturalization application, or if the court chooses to infer, a case under 1447B. But the question that the Hovsepian, Etape, and Bustamante courts in the 9th, 4th, and 2nd circuits came to, whether there's concurrent or exclusive jurisdiction, is one that this court does not need to address in such a remand. And indeed, the government's arguments, procedural arguments that Mr. Al-Jabri has failed to state a claim would certainly be just as salient before the district court.
I don't understand why we wouldn't have to reach it, because if the May 3, 2012 action by CIS purporting to adjudicate the claim was a valid action, then I understood you to be arguing that this case was moot.
That is correct.
And there are constitutional implications to our power that flow from mootness. So I am personally dubious that we could just fail to reach a question that might be dispositive as to our authority to go forward. We couldn't just send something back to the district court and say, figure out if it's moot. This seems to be a legal issue to me about whether there's exclusive or concurrent jurisdiction. So I had thought we needed to resolve that question to find out if there was any force to the May 3, 2012 order. And if there is force to the May 3, 2012 order, the whole thing goes away. If there's not, if that was a premature action on the agency's part because the authority had moved to the district court, then there's something for the district court to do. Perhaps, as Judge Kenney suggests, just ship it back to the agency for action.
Well, judges, I think that if the court wants to address that issue, it can address the issue. Now, the question in the order setting the briefing issues does squarely ask whether this case is moot, and the government has briefed.
Yeah, no,
that,
we appreciate it.
That the case is moot as well. So on that third choice the court can take, it can address that issue. The government recognizes that the Seventh Circuit would be deciding on an issue that its sister circuits have decided in a different way. But the court really should take a look at Judge Hamilton's dissent in Etape. rather lays out the arguments that the government makes, as well as the Bustamante court's considerations of the government's arguments. And just to quickly reiterate them, not to repeat something that's well briefed, there's four reasons for concurrent jurisdiction. First, the government argument is that the plain language of the statute of 1447B does not strip jurisdiction from the agency. The agency that's empowered to decide these naturalization applications in the first place. And indeed, on top of that, taking into context the statutory regime, 1447B with 1429 and 1421C, the Kleeny Court addressed the question of 1421C and whether 1429 bars jurisdiction. Indeed, it does not, and Judge Caney sitting on that panel, that's just a mandatory rule. In this circumstance, the plain language allows for efficiency. Now, of course, Mr. Roth and the Hovsepian Court and the Bustamante and Atape courts have concluded that efficiency would be precluded or limited based on a concurrent reading of jurisdiction. But in this circumstance, especially in this circumstance, it can be more efficient. The ultimate reason why 1447B was passed by Congress was not for judicial efficiency, but for the swiftness of adjudication for the alien applicant for naturalization, and allowing the agency, CIS, even though it didn't adjudicate within 120 days in the first blush, to decide that issue up front and concurrently with the district court, really is the goal of the statute. And it follows that this is also a consistent reading with Brock. Of course, courts have disagreed and reasonable minds can differ, but under Brock, this would be the less restrictive remedy. And indeed, 1447B, the government contends, is not an adverse consequence to a non-adjudication of a naturalization application 120 days after the naturalization interview.
Even though this was, what more than 30 times 120 days?
Well, Your Honor, certainly you're correct about that. Oh, I don't know. I don't know the exact math, but that sounds about right. But there are certain factors here. You know, just going through the timeline, on May 4, 2003, or February 4, 2003, over 10 years ago, Mr. Al-Jabri filed his naturalization application. However, in March of 2003, he started committing food stamp fraud, where he defrauded the United States government of over $1 million. By buying food stamps from food stamp recipients.
Remember his case. Don't worry.
Certainly. I recognize that. His naturalization interview occurred on July 31st, 2003. And I don't know why, but it could certainly be the case where CIS knew that there was an investigation taking place, where there was something going on, where there were some questions that needed to be resolved before the agency could faithfully and appropriately decide the naturalization application. I see that I'm out of time. I can keep explaining.
Okay. Well, I don't need anything else. Your brief is
well, I have
thorough.
One question. Is sure. We're talking about this delay in time. How about on Wednesday? Are you going to have any travel money to come out back to Chicago?
Well, Your Honor, that's why I'm flying back today. So I can be in D.C. when I don't have to go to work tomorrow.
Actually, this is a pretty nice town to get stuck in. But
my family's from the North Shore. I'm sitting right back here. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
How much time? You have three minutes. 3 minutes, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple points. In terms of Mr. Al-Jabri has pro se litigated this. His habeas appeal to this court was not pro se, the one that he prevailed on. And I would note that while he didn't cite 1447B in his original complaint, he actually did cite it, and Atape and Hovsepian, in his motion to alter or amend the judgment. I don't think at the time the district court rendered its final judgment, I don't think there was any fair dispute that 1447B was one of the grounds of jurisdiction on which he was attempting to rely. The government... argues this Brock issue. I mean, Brock involved a situation where the question was whether the agency lost authority to recover mishandled money because the agency didn't sue about it quickly enough. And that's just a far cry from the situation where Congress transfers, authorizes a district court to decide a matter instead of an agency. Congress in this is this 1447B dates to 1990. It's the Immigration Act of 1990, which is what transferred authority from the district courts, which used to adjudicate naturalization matters, to the agency, but has an exception that the district court can keep jurisdiction in these matters where there's a delay. It's not simply a sort of glorified mandamus that allows a court to speed up agency adjudications. It's a question of who gets to decide. 1447B says when the agency delays that the individual can ask the district court to decide, and the district court can decide whether it wants to decide. And sometimes it may make sense and sometimes it doesn't. But it's not, you wouldn't normally say that a request for naturalization is mooted by denial of the naturalization. I mean, this isn't, a mandamus does, I suppose, moot out when if you want just a decision, any old decision, you know, gives you what you asked for. But when you're asking for naturalization and you're asking the district court to grant it for you, you wouldn't normally say that moots out naturalization. So we think their argument it has a nice sound to it at points, but in the end of the day, it doesn't take account of the remand language of the statute. So the courts have asked, if remand, why would you need to remand if the agency could have decided it all along? It doesn't make account of the determine language if the agency can determine the matter and the district court can't determine the matter. So we feel very we ask the court to reverse the district court's decision and to remand the matter for further proceedings. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.